Given only minutes to dress and gather their possessions, the Grumman students boarded the Thopter. The wings went to full extension, then began a powerful flapping rhythm as the craft flew through the rain over the dark water until its red strobe faded like a dying star. The universe is a place inaccessible, unintelligible, completely absurd, from which life, especially rational life, is estranged. There is no place of safety or basic principle upon which the universe depends. There are only transitory, masked relationships, confined within limited dimensions, and bound for inevitable change. Meditations from Bifrost Erie, Buddhist-Islamic Text. Rabban's slaughter of the fur whales in Tula Fjord was only the first in a chain of disasters to strike Abelard Harkonnen. On a sunny day, when the ice and snow had begun to thaw after a long, hard winter, a terrible avalanche buried Bifrost Erie, the greatest of the mountain retreats built by reclusive Buddhist-Islamic monks. It was also the ancestral home of House Rabban. The snow came down like a white hammer, sweeping away everything in its path. It crushed buildings, buried thousands of religious devotees. Emmy's father, Onir Rautha Rabban, sent a plea for help directly to Abelard's main lodge. With knotted stomachs, Abelard and Emmy took an ornithopter, leading larger transports filled with local volunteers. He piloted with one hand while clutching her fingers with his other. For a lingering moment he studied the strong profile of his wife's wide face and her long black hair. Though she wasn't beautiful in any classic sense, he never tired of looking at her, or of being with her. They traveled along the folded coastline, then deep into the rugged mountain ranges. Many of the isolated retreats had no roads leading to the crags in which they nestled. All raw materials were extracted from the mountains. All supplies and people came via Thopter. 4 generations ago, a weak House Rabban had surrendered planetary, industrial, and financial rights to the Harkonnens, on the condition that they be allowed to live in peace. The religious orders built monasteries and focused their energies on scriptures and sutras in an attempt to understand the subtlest nuances of theology. House Harkonnen couldn't have cared less. Bifrost Erie had been one of the first cities built like a dream of Shangri-La in the Backbone Ranges. Chiseled stone buildings were situated on cliffs so high that they remained above Lankavile's perpetual cloud level. Viewed from meditation balconies, the peaks floated like islands on a sea of white cumulus. The towers and minarets were covered with gold, painstakingly extracted from distant mines. Every flat wall surface was etched with friezes or intaglios depicting ancient sagas and metaphors for moral choices. Abelard and Emmy had been to Bifrost Erie many times, to visit her father, or just to go on retreats when they needed relaxation. Upon returning to Lankavile after 7 years on dusty Arrakis, he and his wife had required a month at Bifrost Erie just to cleanse their minds. And now an avalanche had nearly destroyed that great monument. Abelard didn't know how he could bear to see it. They sat together tensely as he flew the ornithopter high, holding the vehicle steady and bucking air currents. Since there were few landmarks and no roads, he relied on coordinates for the Thopter's nav systems. The craft came over one razorback range and into a glacier-filled bowl, then up a rugged black slope to where the city should have been. The sunlight was dazzling. With her jasper-brown eyes, Emmy looked ahead, counting peaks and orienting herself, before she pointed, still not releasing his hand from her tightening grip. Abelard recognized a few glittering gold spires, the milky white stones that held up the magnificent buildings. Fully a third of Bifrost Erie had been erased, as if a giant broom of snow had smoothed everything over, obliterating any obstruction, whether cliff or building or praying monk. The Fokker landed in what had been the town square, now cleared as a staging area for rescue and salvage parties. The surviving monks and visitors had swarmed out onto the snowfield. The robed figures used makeshift tools and even bare hands to rescue survivors, but mostly to recover frozen bodies. Abelard climbed out of the thopter and reached up to help his wife down. He was afraid her legs might be shaking as much as his were. Although cold gusts cast ice crystals like gritty sand in their faces, the tears that sprang to Abelard's pale eyes were not caused by the wind. Seeing them arrive, the barrel-chested burgomaster, Onir Rautha Rabban, came forward. His mouth opened and closed above a bearded chin, but he remained speechless. Finally, he just threw his thick arms around his daughter and gave Emmy a long hug. Abelard embraced his father-in-law. Bifrost Eyrie had been famed for its architecture, for prismatic crystal windows that reflected rainbows back into the mountain. The people who dwelled there were artisans who crafted precious items sold off-world to affluent, discriminating customers. Most famed of all were the irreplaceable books of delicate calligraphy and illuminated manuscripts of the enormous orange Catholic Bible. Only the wealthiest great houses in the Landsraad could afford a Bible hand-lettered and embellished by the monks of Lankavile. Of particular interest had been the singing crystal sculptures, harmonic quartz formations taken from cave grottos, arranged carefully and tuned to proper wavelengths, so that the resonance of one crystal, when tapped, would set up a vibration in the next, and the next, in a harmonic wave, a music unlike any other in all the Imperium. "More work crews and transports are on their way," Abelard said to Onir Rautha Rabban. "They're bringing equipment and emergency supplies." "All we can see is grief and tragedy," Emmy said. "I know it's too soon for you to think clearly now, Father, but if there's anything else we can do..." The square-shouldered man with the gray beard nodded. "Yes, there is, my daughter." Onir looked Abelard straight in the eye. "Our tithe to House Harkonnen is due next month. We've sold enough crystals, tapestries, and calligraphy, and we had the proper amount of solaris set aside. But now..." He gestured to the ruins from the avalanche. "It's all buried in there somewhere, and what money we have we'll need in order to pay for..." In the original agreement between Houses Rabban and Harkonnen, all of the religious cities on Lankavile agreed to pay a specified sum each year. As a result, they were free of other obligations and left alone. Abelard held up his hand. "Not to worry." Despite his family's tradition of harshness, Abelard had always done his best to live well, to treat others with the respect they deserved. But ever since his son's whale hunt had ruined the breeding grounds in Tula Fjord, he found himself slipping into a dark, deep hole. Only the love he shared with Emmy maintained him, providing him with strength and optimism. "You can have all the time you need. What's important now is to find any survivors, and to help you rebuild." Onir Rautha Rabban looked too devastated even to weep. He stared at the people working on the mountainside. The sun was bright overhead, and the sky a clear blue. The avalanche had painted his world a pristine white, covering the depth of misery it brought. On Gedi Prime, in the private chamber where he often went to brood with his nephew and his mentat, Baron Harkonnen reacted to the news with appropriate indignation. In the midst of clutter, he bounced in his suspensor mechanism, while the others sat in chair dogs. A new, mostly ornamental walking stick rested against the chair, close at hand in case he needed to snatch it up and strike someone. This stick featured a Harkonnen griffin on its head, unlike the sandworm head of the one he had thrown off the balcony. Decorative pillars rose in each corner of the room, squared off in a jumbled architectural style. A dry fountain sat in one corner. There were no windows. The Baron rarely bothered looking at the view anyway, and the polished tile felt cold against his bare feet, which touched the floor like a whisper, thanks to his suspensers. In one corner of the room, a pole bearing the drooping banner of House Harkonnen lay tilted against the wall, tossed there casually and never righted. The Baron glowered over at Glossu Rabban. "Your father's showing his soft heart and his soft head again." Rabban flinched, afraid he might be sent back to talk sense into Abelard. He wore a padded sleeveless jacket of maroon leather that left his muscular arms bare. His close-cropped reddish hair had been smashed into a cowlick from the helmet he often wore. "I wish you wouldn't keep reminding me that he's my father," he said, trying to deflect the Baron's anger. "For 4 generations the income stream from Lankavile's monasteries has been unbroken. That was our agreement with House Rabban. They always pay. They know the terms. And now, because of a little—" the Baron snorted. "Snowfall? They're going to shirk their tithe? How can Abelard blithely wave his hands and excuse his subjects from their tax obligations? He is the planetary governor, and he has responsibilities."
"We can always make the other cities pay more," Peter de Vries suggested.
He twitched as additional possibilities occurred to him. He got up from the chair-dog and moved across the chamber toward the Baron. The loose-fitting robe curled around him as he glided with the grace and silence of a vengeful ghost. "I don't agree with setting a precedent like this," the Baron said. "I prefer our finances all neat and tidy, and Lankavile has managed to remain clean until now."
He reached over to a side table and poured himself a snifter of Kirana brandy. He sipped it, hoping the smoky-tasting liquid would burn the ache from his joints. Since being fitted with his belt mechanism, the Baron had gained even more weight from reduced activity. His physical body felt like a burden hanging on his bones. The Baron's skin bore an aroma of eucalyptus and cloves from the oils he added to his daily bath. The massage boys had rubbed ointments deep into his skin, but his deteriorating body still felt miserable. "If we go easy on one city, it'll lead to an epidemic of manufactured disasters and excuses." He pursed his generous lips in a pout, and his spider-black eyes flicked over to Rabban.
"I can understand why you're displeased, Uncle. My father's a fool."
De Vries raised a long, bony finger.
"If I may make a point, my Baron, Lankavile is lucrative because of its whale fur trade. Virtually all of our profit comes from that one industry. The few trinkets and souvenirs from these monasteries bring a nice price, yes. But overall the income is insignificant. On general principle we require them all to pay, but we don't need them."
The Mentat paused.
"Your point being?"
He raised his bushy eyebrows.
"The point being, my Baron, that in this particular instance we can afford to, shall we say, make a point of the matter?"
Rabban began to laugh, a booming chuckle similar to his uncle's. His exile on Lankavile still rankled. "House Harkonnen controls the fief of Rabban Lankavile," the Baron said. "With fluctuations in the spice market, we need to ensure our absolute control in every money-making enterprise. Perhaps we've been lax in watching over my half-brother's activities. He may feel he can be as lenient as he wishes, and that we'll ignore him. This sort of thinking needs to stop." "What are you going to do, Uncle?" Rabban leaned forward, and his thick-lidded eyes narrowed.
"It's what you are going to do. I need someone familiar with Lankavile, and someone who understands the requirements of power."
Rabban swallowed with anticipation, knowing what was coming.
"You're going back there," the Baron ordered. "But this time not in disgrace. This time you have a job to do."
The Bene Gesserit tell no casual lies. Truth serves us better. Bene Gesserit Coda. On an overcast morning, Duke Leto sat alone in the courtyard of Castle Caladan, staring at an untouched breakfast of smoked fish and eggs. A magnaboard containing metal-impregnated paper documents rested by his right hand. Kailia seemed to be attending to fewer of the daily business matters. So much to do, and none of it interesting. Across the table lay the remains of Thufir Hawat's meal. The Mentat had eaten hurriedly and departed to tend to the security details required for the day's affair of state. Leto's thoughts kept wandering to the Highliner that had entered orbit, and the shuttle that would soon come down to the surface. What do the Bene Gesserit want of me? Why are they sending a delegation to Caladan? He'd had nothing further to do with the Sisterhood since Romber had taken Tesha as his bound concubine. Their representative wanted to speak to him about an extremely important matter, yet refused to reveal anything further. His stomach knotted, and he hadn't slept well the night before. The insanity of the Mauritani-Ikazi conflict weighed constantly on his mind. While he had gained stature in the Landsraad for his determined diplomatic efforts, he was sickened by the recent kidnapping and execution of the Archduke's family members. Leto had met Armand Ikaz's daughter, Sanya, found her attractive, had even considered her a good marriage prospect. But Grumman thugs had killed Sanya and her uncle. He knew this would not be solved without further bloodshed. Leto watched a bright orange and yellow butterfly flutter above a vase of flowers at the center of the table. For an instant, the pretty insect made him forget his troubles. But the questions seeped back into his awareness. Years ago, at his trial by forfeiture, the Bene Gesserit had offered him assistance, though he knew better than to expect unfettered generosity. Thufir Hawat had given Leto a warning he already knew too well. The Bene Gesserit aren't errand girls for anyone. They made this offer because they wanted to, because it benefits them somehow. Hawat was right, of course. The Sisterhood was adept at securing information, power, and position. A Bene Gesserit of hidden rank was married to the Emperor. Shaddam IV kept an ancient truth-sayer at his side at all times. Another sister had wed Shaddam's spice minister, Count Hasimir Fenring. Why have they always been so interested in me? He wondered. The butterfly landed on the magna board beside his hand, showing off its beautiful patterned wings. Even with advanced Mentat abilities, Hawat could provide no useful projections regarding the Sisterhood's motives. Perhaps Leto should ask Tesha. Romber's concubine usually gave straightforward answers. But even though Tesha was now part of the Atreides household, the young woman remained loyal to the Sisterhood. And no organization kept its secrets better than the Bene Gesserit. With a flash of color, the butterfly danced in the air in front of his eyes. He extended a hand, palm up. And, to his surprise, the creature landed on it, perching so lightly that he barely felt a thing. "Do you have the answers I'm looking for? Is that what you're trying to tell me?" The butterfly had placed its complete faith in him, trusting that Leto wouldn't harm it. So it was, too, with the sacred trust the good people of Caladan placed in him. The butterfly darted off and dropped to the ground, seeking dew in the shade of the breakfast table. Suddenly a house servant appeared, stepping into the courtyard. "My Duke, the delegation has arrived early. They are already at the spaceport." Leto stood abruptly, knocking the magna board off the table. It tumbled onto the cool flagstones. The servant hurried to pick it up, but Leto brushed him aside when he saw that the butterfly had been crushed beneath it. His own carelessness had killed the delicate creature. Disturbed, he knelt beside it for several seconds. "Are you all right, my lord?" the servant asked. Leto straightened, brushed off the magna board, and assumed a stoic expression. "Inform the delegation that I will meet them in my study, instead of at the spaceport." As the servant hurried off, Leto lifted the dead butterfly and laid it between two magna board sheets. Though the insect's body had been crushed, the exquisite wings remained intact. he would have the creature encased in clearplas, so that he could always remember how easily beauty could be destroyed in a moment of carelessness. With his black uniform, green cape, and ducal badge of office in place, Leto rose from his alaca wood desk. He bowed as five black-robed sisters entered, led by a severe-faced, gray-haired woman with hollow cheeks and bright eyes. His gaze shifted to a bronze-haired young beauty beside her, then focused back on the leader.
"I am Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam."
The woman's face showed no hostility, nor did it ease into a smile.
"Thank you for allowing us to speak with you, Duke Leto Atreides."
"Normally I do not grant visits on such short notice," he said with a cool nod. Hawat had advised him to keep the women off balance, if possible. "However, since the sisterhood does not often ask for my indulgence, I can make an exception." A household servant closed the doors of the private study as Leto gestured to his warrior Mentat. "Reverend Mother, may I present Thufir Hawat, my security commander?"
"Ah, the famous Master of Assassins," she said, meeting his gaze.
"An informal title only." Rigid with suspicion, Hawat bowed slightly. Tension hung thick in the air, and Leto did not know how to cut it. As the women took seats in deep cushioned chairs, Leto found himself captivated by the young girl with bronze hair, who remained standing. Perhaps 17 years old, her intelligent green eyes were widely set on an oval face that had a slightly upturned nose and generous lips. She carried herself with a regal bearing. Had he seen her before? He wasn't certain. When Mohiam looked at the young girl, who stood straight and rigid, they exchanged hard stares, as if some strain existed between them.
"This is Sister Jessica, a very talented acolyte, trained in many areas. We would like to present her to your household with our compliments."
"Present her to us?" Hawat said with a hard edge in his voice. "As a servant or as your spy?" The girl looked at him sharply, but quickly covered her indignation.
"As a consort, or just a sounding board for ideas. That is for the Duke to decide."
Mohiam calmly ignored the Mentat's accusatory tone.
"Bene Gesserit sisters have proven their value as advisers to many houses, including House Carino."
She kept her attention firmly on Leto, though it was clear she remained aware of every movement Hawat made.
"A sister may observe and draw her own conclusions, but that does not make her a spy. Many nobles find our women to be fine companions, beautiful, skilled in the arts of..."
Leto cut her off. "I already have a concubine who is the mother of my son." He glanced at Hawat, saw the Mentat analyzing the new data. Mohiam gave him a knowing smile.
"An important man such as yourself may have more than one woman, Duke Atreides. You have not yet chosen a wife."
"Unlike the Emperor, I do not maintain a harem." The other sisters looked impatient, and the Reverend Mother let out a long sigh.
"The traditional meaning of the word harem, Duke Atreides, included all the women for whom a man bore responsibility, including his sisters and mother, as well as concubines and wives. There was no implied sexual connotation."
"Word games," Leto growled.
"Do you wish to play word games, Duke Leto, or strike a bargain?"
The Reverend Mother glanced over at Hawat as if considering how much to say in front of the Mentat.
"A matter involving House Atreides has come to our attention. It concerns a certain plot perpetrated against you years ago."
With a barely perceptible jerk, Hawat focused his attention. Leto leaned forward.
"What plot, Reverend Mother?" "Before we reveal this vital information to you, we must arrive at an understanding."
Leto wasn't the slightest bit surprised.
"Is it so much we ask in return?"
Because of the urgency of the situation, Mohiam thought it might be necessary to use voice on him, but the Mentat would surely recognize it. Jessica remained standing to one side, on display. Any other nobleman would be glad to have this lovely child as part of his retinue, in any capacity. Leto's thoughts whirled. It's clear they want to have someone here on Caladan. For what purpose? Just to exert influence? Why would they bother? Tesha is already here, if they need a spy so badly. House Atreides has respect and influence, but is not particularly powerful in the Landsraad. Why have I come to their notice? And why are they so insistent upon this particular girl? Leto came around in front of the desk and gestured to Jessica. Come here. The young woman glided across the small study. A head shorter than the Duke, with unblemished and radiant skin, she gave him a long, importunate look. I've heard that all Bene Gesserit are witches, he said, as he ran a finger through the bronze silkiness of her hair. She met his gaze and responded in a soft voice. But we have hearts and bodies. Her lips were softly sensual, inviting. Ah, but what have your heart and body been trained to do? She fended off his question in a tranquil tone. Trained to be loyal, to offer the comforts of love, to have children. Leto glanced at Thufir Hawat. No longer in a Mentat trance, the leathery warrior nodded, indicating that he did not object to the bargain. In their private discussions, however, the two had planned an aggressive tack with the delegation, to see how the Bene Gesserit would respond under pressure, to keep them off balance so the Mentat could observe. This appeared to be the opportunity they had discussed. I don't believe the Bene Gesserit ever give without taking, Leto snapped in sudden fury. But my lord... Jessica could not complete the sentence, because he snatched a jewel-handled knife from a sheath at his waist and held the blade to her throat, pulling her tightly against him in a hostage position. Her Bene Gesserit companions did not move. They gazed at Leto with unnerving serenity, as if they thought Jessica could kill him herself, if she so chose. Mohiam watched with impenetrable bird-like eyes. Jessica tilted her head back, exposing more of her soft, smooth throat. It was the way of D-wolves, as she had been taught in the mother school. Bare your throat in total submission, and the aggressor backs away. The tip of Leto's blade pressed into her skin ever so slightly, but not enough to draw blood. I don't trust what you offer. Jessica remembered the command Mohiam had whispered in her ear just before they stepped off the shuttle in the Kala Municipal Spaceport. Let the chain be unbroken, her stern mentor had said. You must give us the female child we require. Jessica hadn't been told where she fitted into the sisterhood's breeding programs, and it was not her position to ask. Many young girls were assigned as concubines for various great houses, and she had no reason to believe she was any different from the others. She respected her superiors and worked hard to show this, but sometimes Mohiam's unbending ways chafed her. They'd had an argument on the way here, and the remnants of it still hung in the air. Leto whispered in her ear, I could kill you now. But he could not hide from her, or any of the sisters, that his anger was feigned. Years ago, as a test, she had studied this dark-haired man as she hid in balcony shadows on Wallach 9. She pressed her neck against the blade. You are not a casual killer, Leto Atreides. He withdrew the edge, but kept his arm around her waist as she said, You have nothing to fear from me. Do we have a deal, Duke Leto? Mohiam asked, unruffled by his behavior. I assure you our information is quite
revealing.
Leto didn't like being cornered, but he stepped away from Jessica.
You say a plot has been perpetrated against me?
A smile worked at the wrinkled corners of the Reverend Mother's mouth.
First, you must agree to the contract. Jessica stays here and is to be treated with due respect.
Leto and his warrior Mentat exchanged glances. She can live in Castle Caladan, he said finally, but I do not agree to take her into my bed.
Mohiam shrugged.
Use her as you wish.
Jessica is a valuable and useful resource, but do not waste her talents.
Biology will take its course.
Reverend Mother, what is your vital information?
Hawat demanded.
Clearing her throat, Mohiam replied, I speak of an incident some years back, in which you were falsely accused of attacking two Tleilaxu ships. We have learned that Harkonnens were involved.
Both Leto and Hawat stiffened.
The Mentat's brows furrowed in deep concentration as he awaited further data.
You have proof of this? Leto asked.
They used an invisible warship to fire upon the Tleilaxu vessels, implicating you, in an attempt to start an Atreides-Tleilaxu war. We have the wreckage of the craft in our possession.
An invisible ship? I've never heard of such a thing.
Nonetheless, it exists. We have the prototype, the only one of its kind. Fortunately, the Harkonnens experienced technical problems, which contributed to its crash near our mother school. We have also determined that the Harkonnens are unable to manufacture another such ship.
The Mentat studied her.
Have you analyzed the technology?
The nature of what we discovered cannot be revealed. Such a fearsome weapon could wreak tremendous havoc in the Imperium.
Leto barked a short laugh, elated that he finally had an answer to the question that had nagged him for 15 years.
Thufir, we'll take this information to the Landsrat and clear my name once and for all. Reverend Mother, provide us with all of your evidence and documentation.
Mohiam shook her head. That is not part of our bargain. The tempest has abated, Duke Leto. Your trial by forfeiture is over, and you have been acquitted of the charges.
But not cleared. Some of the great houses still suspect I was involved. You could provide conclusive proof of my innocence.
Does that mean so much to you, Duke Leto?
Her eyebrows rose.
Perhaps you could find a more effective way to spend this coin. The Sisterhood will not support such an endeavor simply to bolster your pride or salve your conscience.
Leto felt helpless and very young in the face of Mohiam's intense stare.
How can you come to me with information like that and expect me not to act on it? If I have no proof of what you say, then your information is meaningless.
Mohiam frowned, and her dark eyes glittered.
Come now, Duke Leto. Is House Atreides interested only in trappings and documents? I thought you valued the truth for itself. I have given you the truth.
So you say, Hawat answered coldly.
The wise leader understands patience.
Ready to depart, Mohiam signaled to her companions.
One day you will discover the best way to use the knowledge. But take heart. Simply understanding what truly occurred in that highliner should be worth a great price to you, Duke Leto Atreides.
Hawat was about to object, but Leto held up his hand.
She's right, Thufir. Those answers are quite valuable to me.
He looked over at the bronze-haired girl.
Jessica can stay here.
The man who gives in to adrenaline addiction turns against all humanity. He turns against himself. He runs away from the workable issues of life and admits a defeat which his own violent actions help to create.
Kamar Pilru, Ixian Ambassador in Exile, Treatise on the Downfall of Unjust Governments.
The secret shipment of explosives arrived intact, passed by bribed off-world delivery crews, hidden among crates, delivered to a specific loading dock in the cave openings in the cliffs of the Port of Entry Canyon. Working with the loaders, Kater spotted the subtle markings and diverted the innocuous-looking container, as he had done many times before. When he uncovered the cleverly packaged explosive wafers, though, he was astounded. There must be 1,000 of them. Other than handling instructions for the charges, there was no message, coded or otherwise, and no source information. But Kater knew the identity of the sender anyway. This was far more than Prince Romber had ever sent before. Kater felt renewed hope, and the burden of tremendous responsibility. Only a few other wary, independent rebels remained underground, and they kept to themselves, trusting no one. Kater was that way himself. Other than Miral Alekhem, he felt all alone in his fight, even though Romber, and the Tleilaxu, apparently thought there was a much larger, more organized resistance. These explosives would make up for that. During his youth, Prince Romber Vernius had been a pudgy boy. Kater remembered him as something of a good-natured buffoon, who spent more time collecting geological specimens than learning statecraft or Ixian industrial processes. There had always seemed to be time. But everything had changed when the Tleilaxu came. Everything. Even in exile, Romber still had passcodes and connections with the shipping administration by which raw materials came into the manufacturing city. He had been able to smuggle vital supplies underground. And now these explosive wafers. Kater vowed to make each one count. Now his primary concern was to hide the demolition's material before sluggish Ixian suboids discovered the package's true contents. Wearing the stolen uniform of an upper-level worker, he transported the shipment of explosives into the stalactite city on a suspensor cart with other everyday deliveries. He did not hurry toward his hiding place. At all times he kept his expression bland and passive, making no conversation, barely responding to comments or insults made by the Tleilaxu masters. When he finally reached the appropriate level and ducked through the camouflaged entrance into his sensor-shielded room, Kater piled the black, rough-textured wafers, then lay back on his cot, breathing heavily. This would be his first major strike in years. He closed his eyes. Moments later, he heard a click at the door, footsteps, and a rustling noise. He didn't move or look because the sounds were familiar. A small bit of comfort for him in an uncomfortable world. He smelled her faint, sweet scent. For months he had been living with Miral Alekhem. They had clung to each other's companionship after making love in a darkened tunnel, hushed and nervous, while hiding from a Sardaukar patrol. In his years as an Ixian patriot, Kater had resisted the urge for any sort of a personal relationship, spurning close contact with other human beings. It was too dangerous, too distracting. But Miral had the same burning goals, the same needs, and she was so beautiful. Now he heard her set something down on the floor with a soft thump. She kissed his cheek. "I got a few things. Some high-energy wire, a laser pack, a..." He heard her indrawn gasp of breath. Kater smiled, kept his eyes closed. She'd spotted the piles of wafers. "I got a few things, too." Abruptly he sat up and explained how he'd come by the explosives, and how they worked. Each black wafer, the size of a small coin and honeycombed with compressed detonation beads, packed enough power to blow up a small building. With just a handful of them, placed correctly, they could cause tremendous, large-scale damage. Her fingers moved close to the pile, hesitated. She looked at him with her large, dark eyes, and as she did, he thought about her, as he often did. Miral was the best person he'd ever met. It was admirable the way she took risks comparable to his own. She hadn't seduced him, hadn't enticed him at all. Their relationship had just happened. They were right for each other. He thought briefly of his youthful crush on Kylea, the daughter of Earl Vernius. That had been a fantasy, a game, which might have become real if Ix had not fallen. Meral, though, was all the reality he could endure. "Don't worry," he assured her. "It takes a detonator to set them off." He pointed to a small red box filled with needle-set timing devices. She took one of the wafers in each hand, inspecting it like a Hagal jeweler with a new fire gem. Kater could imagine the possibilities streaming through her mind. Stress points in the city. Places where the explosives would cause the most pain and damage to the invaders. "I've already chosen a few targets," he said. "I was hoping you'd help out." She replaced the wafers carefully, then dropped with him onto the cot in an embrace. "You know I will." Her breath was hot in his ear. They could hardly wait to get their clothes off. After making love with an intensity fanned by their great plans, Kater slept for more hours than he usually allowed himself. When he was rested and ready, he and Meral went through the motions repeatedly in order to ensure that every connection was made, all procedures and safeguards set. After they had rigged several charges in the shielded room, they took the remaining explosives and stepped to the sealed doorway, checking the scanners to make certain the outer corridor was empty. With sadness, Kater and Meral bade a silent farewell to the shielded chamber that had been Kater's desperate hiding place for so long. Now it would serve one last purpose, enabling them to deliver a stinging blow to the invaders. The Bene Tlaelox would never know what hit them. Kater stacked the boxes one at a time with other crates necessary for whatever experiments the Tlaelox who conducted inside their high-security research pavilion. One of the boxes was rigged with explosive wafers, a shipment that looked just like the others being loaded onto the automated rail system. The package would be delivered right into the heart of their secret lair. He did not waste a glance on the booby-trapped crate. He simply stacked it with all the others, then surreptitiously set the timer, and hurried to add another container. One of the suboid laborers stumbled, and Kater picked up the man's designated crate and lifted it onto the rail car bed to avoid a delayed departure. He had given himself a sufficient window of opportunity, but still found it hard not to let his nervousness show. Miral Alekum was in the passageway beneath another building. She would be setting charges at the base of the immense structure that had Tlaelaxu offices on upper levels. By now she should have made good her escape. With a humming sound, the loaded pallet shuddered into motion and cruised along the rail, picking up speed toward the laboratory complex. Kater longed to know what went on behind those blind windows. Miral had not been able to find out, and neither had he. But he would be satisfied just to cause damage.